The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Thursday, the 9th of May, 2019. On the podcast today, I have Larry Bottomley, Chief Executive Officer of Charat Oil & Gas. C-H-A-R is ticker there. And Larry discusses the completion of the Independent Competent Persons Report on their gas prospects in Morocco. Also on the podcast, I have Vadim Alexander, Head of Healthcare, SP Angel, discussing Motive Bio. Plus, Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com, covers some results of the day from BT, from Superdry, and Barrett Developments. And as always, two lists I have for you. Top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. And basically, it's a measure of money flow or a search, you know. People only follow companies they're investing in or researching about to invest in. So it's worth looking at that list on the front page of voxmarkets.co.uk. It's top 10 there. And also, the other list I'm going to read out to you is top five most liked RNSs. And you can see top 10 version there as well. Plus, on the front page, of course, lots of other content. And don't forget, if you do use the Vox Markets app, I highly recommend it. It's free, but if you do and you get some value from it, by all means, give us a rating on Apple or on Android stores where you get it from, and it'll help other people find it out if they're looking for investment apps.
To receive free company updates straight to the front screen of your smartphone whenever a company you follow releases significant news, download the free Vox Markets app. From voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Larry Bottomley, Chief Executive Officer of Charat Oil & Gas. C-H-A-R is the ticker there. Larry, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me, Justin.
Yeah, and you've had some significant news out, and it's nice to get you on, because I've had people mention your company to me before, so it's nice to get you on. But you've had a significant bit of news out of CPR on your Moroccan assets, and we'll dig into the detail of that in a bit. Before we do, Larry, for me, for others who are not quite familiar with the company, can you just summarise what Charat Oil & Gas is all about, please?
Great, certainly, I'd be happy to. The company is a high-impact Atlantic margins oil and gas company, and we've got a balanced exploration portfolio that ranges across three countries in the offshore. So that's in Morocco, Brazil, and in Namibia. And the portfolio that we've built, and particularly with the most recent addition, ranges from discovered resources in Morocco, low-risk exploration opportunities that have got the capacity to be tied back into that discovery, low-risk exploration assets that can work on a standalone basis, and then giant potential assets, so things that would be truly transformational to the company and the countries that we work in the rest of the portfolio. Specifically within that set, the discovery that we secured last month, that's of the order of 70 million barrels of oil equivalent. And the CPR that we have just undertaken is associated with the low-risk exploration assets that we've got the potential for tying back into that discovery. And then the other part with the company is that we've historically been successful in partnering as we go through the portfolio. We've got a great team operationally; it's got an excellent reputation, and we've demonstrated our ability to be able to drill deep water wells very effectively and progress assets through the value chain. And at this point, we're very fortunate in that we're sitting on a very good cash pile, our year-end cash at $19.8 million, significantly in excess of our commitments, which are de minimis, less than $1 million of commitment throughout that portfolio. So I think as a 30-second overview, that's a pretty decent description of the company. There's a lot more information and detail on that and in the assets, and that can be found at our website, which is www.charatoilandgas.com.
Yeah, no, I highly recommend going there, because I've got lots of websites, investor websites, and sometimes they haven't been updated. It's not very easy to find detail, but right there in the operations section there, I can see Brazil, Morocco, Namibia. I can see prospective resources there, and it's very clear and very well laid out. So let's go into today's news. You've got a CPR out on your Moroccan assets. Can you take us through the detail of that, please, Larry?
Okay. Well, we have three licenses in Morocco, Mohammedia and Kenitra, and the Lixus license. And the Lixus license was one that we secured at the beginning of April. So it's been part of our portfolio for a very short time. That block contains the Anchois gas discovery. And this is a well that was drilled in 2009, went through two thick sands, and these sands are absolutely exceptional quality, 25 to 30% porosity, multi-darcy wells. And the individual wells in these sands, we've modeled them, they could have the capacity to deliver up to 50 million cubic feet a day. So that's sort of close to 10,000 barrels of oil equivalent within those individual wells. So within the discovery, what we were able to do prior to the award was to get the discovery itself, the competent person to support the description of that. Since the award, we've been continuing to work with Netherland Sewell, who are the auditors, and they've now completed the audit of the prospects, the satellites that ring the Anchois discovery. So the Anchois discovery sits in the western part of the block. Within the well itself, the 2C contingent resources, there were two sands that were encountered, is 307 BCF. 2C resources, that's the proved and probable part if we were to take this through into a development. 307 BCF, so that proved and probable part, that's equivalent to 50 million barrels of oil equivalent. In the discovery itself, so just slightly offset from the well, is a deeper sand, and that sand has 116 BCF of potential. So between those, between what's been discovered and what is prospective within the discovery itself, that's 423 BCF, 70 million barrels of oil equivalent. So that's the remaining recoverable resource associated with the Anchois discovery, and we were able to announce that a month ago. In the meantime, Netherland Sewell have been working on the satellites, and there are five satellites that ring the Anchois discovery. And those satellites add up to 588 BCF of prospective resources. That's just shy of 100 million barrels of oil equivalent in these prospective resources. And the biggest of those satellites, this is the Anchois North Prospect, which sits slightly to the north of the Anchois field, is 308 BCF of prospective resources in the 2U case. So 308 BCF, again, that's 50 million barrels of oil equivalent that sits within that. And the risk that's assigned to that is 43% probability of geological success. So we've got very low risk satellites that sit and ring around the Anchois field. The Anchois field is has these reservoirs that have the potential for very high rates, and of course the whole discovery and the whole block sits within Morocco, which has a growing energy market and an excellent gas price between $8.50 and $9 an MCF going into the power market locally. So the context of the CPR gives us a resource base that is very commercially attractive within that within the discovery and surrounding the discovery.
Yeah, I'd say, well, just Morocco alone, you've got enough to be getting on with there without Brazil and Namibia, but it's quite impressive. So what's the next steps here then, Larry?
In terms of the Lixus block and the Anchois discovery and field, there's a series of other projects that we're working through, and these will be catalysts. So we've now got the CPR that totally describes Anchois and its satellites. We're also in the process of working through a feasibility study. So this is the engineering that would be required to be able to develop this asset and to export the gas into the market. We expect that will be completed within the next month, and then we'll be able to put that out into the market. In parallel, We're working with a group called Gas Strategies, and we're looking at the gas market within Morocco. Clearly, that's an important part because we'll need to supply gas into the country. Morocco itself is absolutely fascinating, but very exciting from an energy and a power perspective. Most importantly, the Maghreb gas pipeline from Algeria goes through the country and goes into the Iberian Peninsula, and it supplies 30% of the region of 30% of the gas to the Iberian Peninsula, to Spain and to Portugal. Exports in the region of 1.2 BCF a day into that. So there's clearly a market, an export market there that's available. But equally as exciting is what's happening within Morocco, where their energy requirements are expected to double in the next 15 years, and they see gas as being an important part of that. So we'll be completing the feasibility study. We'll be completing the gas marketing study. Those will be announced within the feasibility study within the next month, the gas marketing study thereafter. But in the meantime, we're now progressing that project with all of the entities that we have the potential to partner with. So E&P partners, which is what we normally do within our exploration, but there's also the potential for engaging with midstream and downstream players, people that are involved in pipelines and CPS, who might look to take a risk participation in what it is that we do. And then also we're now connecting with the off-takers, so people who might be interested in taking this gas, so we can start to have the discussions about where we can place that. So there's a whole series of triggers that will be associated with the Anchois discovery and the Lixus license, but also we've got the other portfolio too. So we've got partnering programs going on in Morocco and in Brazil, and in Namibia there'll be a nearby well we expect to drill to our acreage at the beginning of next year. So we will take the results of that and include it through. And of course, we do have a great track record of partnering and farming out. What's very exciting about the Lixus license and the Anchois discovery is that it significantly broadens the number of potential partners. So it's not just E&P, it'll be midstream players, it'll be off-takers, it'll be a whole variety of entities. And so we're really, you know, very excited about being able to get our teeth into a very exciting and a real project.
Yeah, well, I've had a couple of companies on with operations in Morocco, and they've got, you know, just good thing to say about it. So fast, efficient, and economics work well. So it's very interesting, and it's probably worth pointing out as well. You mentioned the cash you have there, and your market cap is not far from that, is it? Really, so just around 17 million, is it?
Yes, no, our year-end cash 19.8. Our market cap is just tracking slightly below that. So at this point, the market has yet to see the value in our assets, but we'll be walking the market forward as we progress the asset, and certainly the CPR and the announcement of the CPR is part of that process.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Larry, on the podcast every day, I highlight the top five most followed companies. And to get on there, of course, people have to hit that follow button on your page. So if someone's listening right now, likes the sound of what you're doing, the progress you're making, but are not following the story, could you give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please?
Okay, well, firstly, I'll just reiterate that that share price essentially being equivalent to the 2018 year-end cash position. So our share price essentially is our cash. There's no value in that for our assets, and that includes not only the Namibian asset and the Brazilian asset and our other exploration assets in Morocco, it also includes the Lixus license, but the Anchois discovery, where we've added 70 million barrels of oil equivalent of remaining recoverable resources by securing that asset last month. And as I mentioned, we'll be going through those triggers The feasibility study, the gas market study, and we would hope that as those progress and as we progress the asset, that the market will start to build the value of that into our share price. I think the second part is that we have a very strong balance sheet and we're in an excellent position. That $19.8 million, the commitments that we have, the only commitment that we have in the portfolio is on the Lixus license in Morocco, and that commitment is less than $1 million. It's a seismic reprocessing campaign, and it essentially gives us many years to progress this project and to go about the partnering program on that project. In terms of the annual operating costs of the company, they're less than $5 million a year last year, and the year before they were $4.2 million. And of course, last year we participated in two deep water wells, one of which we operated. And of course, we have no debt on the balance sheet. So we're in a very strong position to be able to control our own destiny with the operatorship that we have of all of our licenses as we progress through. And then thirdly, and you know, as far as I'm concerned, most importantly, we've got an excellent team. We've got a track record of delivering partners, and we've delivered partners throughout the portfolio. We've got an excellent reputation for delivering operations. Last year, we operated a deep water well in Namibia. That well broke a whole series of benchmarks for operating efficiency during the course of last year. It was a deep water well that was budgeted at $26 million, and we drilled it for $15.8 million, which set a cost benchmark in deep water West Africa that I think is going to be very difficult for the peer group to be able to match. And then finally, our team is absolutely committed to realizing the value in the portfolio, and that's not just Lixus and the Anchois discovery, about which we're very excited, but the rest of our portfolio, including the giant scale opportunities that we have.
Marvellous stuff. Larry, it's good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll catch up again in the not too distant future. Thank you very much.
Okay, no, thank you, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Vadim Alexander, Head of Healthcare, SP Angel. Vadim, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Now, which company are we chatting about today?
So today I want to talk about Motif Bio.
Yes, I know Motif very well. I've had Graham on the podcast several times, and it's been a bit of a stormy ride for them in the last year or so, hasn't it? So I suppose it goes.
Yeah, it's been a difficult year, definitely.
Yeah. So let's first have a summary as to what Motif is all about, please.
Yeah, so Motif is a drug development company. It's a late stage drug development company. Their lead drug is an antibiotic called Iclaprim, which has passed two phase three trials successfully. And they filed with the FDA, and they recently received what's known as a complete response letter, which means that the FDA has not approved their drug in the way it was currently submitted. So that's what I want to talk about today.
Yeah, well, that was the reason why it fell off a cliff. Was it? Because I was chatting to Graham all the way up to the final, or the data, the top line data readouts on their phase three. Some reason, the last time we sort of spoke, I think, or just after that, was it didn't meet the endpoints. Is that right? And then because of that, the share price fell off a cliff. Is that the case?
It's not quite that. So what had happened is the trials met their endpoints. So the drug works as per the two phase three trials.
Yeah.
What came up in the I'll call it the CRL. So it's the complete response letter, which is how the way the FDA communicates with the company, which came back after the submission post the phase three results, which were good. They found an issue with it's not liver toxicity. What they found was there was elevated liver enzymes in the trials, and that was of concern to the FDA. So it wasn't an efficacy issue. It was a safety issue that came up. And the company has then had a meeting with the FDA, which was on May 3rd, and now we're waiting for the minutes from that meeting, and that should be published up. It's usually 30 days after the meeting, so we're expecting it early June. Could come earlier, but that's when we're expecting it. And the minutes will then provide a way forward for Motif, and you know, if there is a way forward. So I would think there will be. I can describe a couple of options of what we think might happen.
So
let's take a step back. The drug works. It had good phase three data. This elevated liver enzymes issue was also seen in the comparator drug. So the way these trials are structured is you are comparing Iclaprim, their drug, mm-hmm. against the standard of care, which is a drug called vancomycin. Mm-hmm. And both arms of the trial had elevated liver enzymes in a certain number of patients. I think in both cohorts, you had about 300 patients. And in both cohorts, you had about 10 to 15 patients with elevated liver enzymes. So again, you know, pretty harsh in terms of an issue being flagged when the drug that's in the market also had elevated liver enzymes, but that's where we are. The company is expecting some kind of request from the FDA on this issue. So what I think might happen is that there are pretty much four options, if you like. One is the worst case scenario is they say, under no circumstance will we approve this drug. Mm-hmm. I think that's highly unlikely just because of the nature of the way this was this came to be. And because of what I just said, the number of patients wasn't actually that high with elevated liver enzymes. And then the standard of care also has this issue. So I don't think that's a likely outcome, but it's always possible, so I have to name it. The second outcome, that's second worst, if you like, is would be more data is required. So go and do some more tox data. So that requires more work, more time, more money for the company. Third option is a label change and a post market trial. So they're known as phase four trials, technically. Mm-hmm. So you can launch the drug with a very restricted label. So meaning, you can only give this drug to patients who have no hepatic issues, so no liver issues, and maybe other restrictions. And then follow up the patients that you do give this drug to until you get a data package that you then resubmit to the FDA and then change the label again. So that's that. And then the fourth outcome, a possible outcome, is just a label change. So all of these are possible. Maybe something else might come out of this meeting. But we're hoping, and there is, a high likelihood that there will be a way forward for Iclaprim, and that's why I want to flag it today, because the minutes are coming out imminently within the next 2 to 3 weeks. For those people who have followed Motif, and I know a lot of people have been, I certainly have been following it for years, and I know a lot of people who invest on AIM have been following Motif for some time. This is a pretty important piece of news flow that's coming for this stock.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, worth saying that, what's the potential here for the drug, if it is commercial and safe and good to go?
Well, this is it. So, antibiotics, we know that there is a major issue globally in terms of antibiotic resistance. So, the world needs new antibiotics, and that's just not going away. And here we have a late stage, approvable antibiotic that's submitted to the FDA, and now they're I guess, at the end of the road, and trying to find a way forward to get this drug approved, for which there is a need. And that need is only going to increase globally. Yeah. It's antibiotic resistance is the only way to resolve this issue of antibiotic resistance is to create new antibiotics.
Yeah. And so, give us again, what's the milestone date? Hopefully, we're looking for.
Yeah. So the 30 days after the May 3rd meeting, which they've had, and they've announced that they've had the meeting, is on June 3rd. So that it doesn't necessarily have to be on June 3rd. It could be earlier, but the protocol from the FDA is that they have to publish the minutes within 30 days.
Okay. And marvelous stuff. Okay. So give us three reasons then. Someone's listening right now, and I know it's quite a popular stock for a while. People are still sort of in there, or they've gone in since the drop. So give us three reasons why someone who's not following the story should hit that follow button on their page on Fox and add them to their watch list, please, Vadim.
Yep, definitely. So look, I guess the key important bit is that the CRL, this complete response letter, does not mean that there is no way forward for Iclaprim. So, it is definitely was a surprise to everyone. It affected the share price. but it doesn't mean the drug is not approvable. The second reason is that there's major news flow imminently. So we're expecting this, you know, if there is a way forward, that would be a major milestone for the business. And then the final reason is, you know, at these levels, it might be good value for, you know, this is not for those that cannot tolerate risk. This is a highly risky, you know, play at this stage. But, you know, we believe that the stock is overshot, you know, because the CRL did not mean that Ecoprim couldn't get approved. So, you know, at these levels, it might be an interesting play.
Yeah. Marvelous stuff. Vadim, thanks for that, fella, and we'll catch up in the not too distant future.
Excellent. Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chris Bailey, founder of financialorbit.com. You're right, Chris.
Very good. Thank you. Very good.
What's your thoughts on the markets of late? They took a bit of a tumble, haven't they? A bit of a fall. They fell out of bed when Trump tweeted that he's going to raise the, you know, the tariffs on China. What do you think? Is it a temporary thing? What's going on here?
Well, I think it is probably a temporary thing in the sense that the president's got an election to win or try to win in 18 months' time. So he can only afford to push things so far. So I think what you're seeing is classic negotiation tactics and related. But, you know, there are some things, proper things to be worried about. I mean, you look back to what the Bank of England said last week, which essentially was, you know, the UK is not the most productive place in the world. We might get higher interest rates at some point. That's not good. We know about the big debt burden in the world, and of course we've had a pretty good run over the last 10 years, so risk preferences are kind of like really high. So, you know, there's always challenges out there, as always, but I see opportunities too. And, you know, I think looking particularly from the perspective of the UK market, we've got ourselves into right old fizz about Brexit. You know, we're not going to open that one up here, but suffice to say, international investor perceptions towards the UK market are rock bottom, and that means as a stock picker, surely there's got to be some opportunities, even if the backdrop is a bit mixed.
Yeah. Do you know what? I had an alert come out yesterday on the IUK Dividend Fund, which I do hold a bit in. It just pays a decent dividend of 6.5%, this BlackRock thing, and iShares. And they're close to, like, not far off. They had a recent dip, you know, in the sell-off end of last year. But apart from that, they're at 7-year lows. And I'm thinking, well, that's why the dividend's so high. I thought, and it's 350 dividend payers, essentially. So you see that category there is not performing well at all, you know?
No, that's right. You know, you look at the FTSE 100 or 350, doesn't matter, large cap stocks. And yeah, as an income investor, you are spoiled, particularly relative to where gilts are or other international bonds that are available. So, you know, as always with high dividend yields, you've got to say, are they sustainable or not? And that comes down to cash flow and everything else. But when I look at some of the big dividend yielders and payers in the FTSE 100, actually, I think... Actually, I think they are sustainable. And actually, on that basis, you've got to be very pessimistic about the world not to be having a decent weighting in stocks today. So, you know, put it all together. I come back to what I said 2 minutes ago. I think there are opportunities.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff. Okay, let's look at individual stocks. What do you reckon there?
Talking about dividends, we've got to talk about BT Group, because what have they done today? They've come up with their full year numbers. This obviously is the first opportunity for the new CEO, who took over a few months ago, to really get to grips with things and have a talk about things and everything else. Everyone, lots of talk about they were going to cut the dividend. He was going to cut it in order to fund change and capital investment and everything else. What's he done? He's held the dividend, not just for the year that's just finished to the end of March 2019, but also has indicated that dividend will be unchanged for the next 12 months as well. And, you know, BT is one of those classic high yielders on the FTSE 100. 15.4 pence dividend yield and a 220-odd pence share price. You know, you don't need to be a math genius to work out that's a pretty attractive dividend yield that they're offering. So good news for dividend munchers from the BT numbers. In terms of what they said, sort of dullness personified, really, in terms of reported revenues, sort of earnings measures were both slightly down. The guidance for the next 12 months is exactly the same, at touchdown on both metrics. He does look to be looking to spend more money in terms of building up their capabilities on all the things that telecoms companies should be worrying about in terms of new fiber technology and related. And that's obviously been a big criticism of BT. They've been a bit sluggish on that in that sense. So he does look to be wanting to do that. He does want to be kicking on sort of the relationship with the Openreach department and division and the government, which is good. So all good sort of sounding stuff. Shares have kind of shrugged their shoulders, are slightly down when I last looked. Yeah. But you have to say, you know, you look at sort of the comments. We still haven't had the conference call and the full comments and everything else. But based on the sort of the flash initial observations, no shocker on the dividend at all. No real shocker actually on the revenue or earnings. People expect them to be downright dull. So at the moment, you've got a high yielding share, which the company appears at this moment to be still committed to that dividend. And then there's still uncertainty about what precisely the new CEO, in tandem with the chairman who's been there for a year or so, both of them known as sort of cost-cutting change people, what exactly and where they're going to take BT. I have to say I'm a holder, you know, full disclosure, I am a holder. And I think the combination of the new CEO and the chair actually is a good one for the company. I am a bit surprised he hasn't cut the dividend to give himself a bit of flexibility. I think that was to some extent factored in. I think what people want to see now is where's the company going in terms of an ability to actually generate positive earnings growth. That's what people want to see. You know, you're only going to get so high a share price from keep on paying that dividend. And that's probably a higher share price than today, but it may not be a full recovery. A full recovery is growth as well as sort of dividend capability.
Yeah, do you know what, I'm just going to say that right at the end, what you said there, you know, all fair and well having a nice bit of a dividend, but if the share price keeps dipping like this every time they announce something, like you say, I think the dividend cut was probably priced in, and oddly disappointed because he didn't cut the dividend, and the stock price is quite frustrating, you know, really frustrating. It went to 260 back in November of last year, then it sort of dipped down, it's back at 216 now. And you're thinking,
right.
I mean, at the end of the day, you know, a company sort of judges, isn't it, on its share price pretty much. And I think if they can't get this up to, you know, because they are, you know, multi-year lows here. And if they can't get this up and they've changed the CEO and all that stuff, new chairman, all this have come in, they can't move the share price north. What's the point in coming in, you know, really?
Absolutely. And often people say, look, a share reaches the bottom when on bad news it goes up. And I thought that was maybe a scenario we might see today. We might see, you know, the classic sort of kitchen sinking by a new CEO who basically says, right, you know, there's a big change required here. I'm going to have to cut and burn, cut jobs, reduce, you know, restructuring spend, whatever it is. We've seen it 1,000 times with other companies. Actually, unless I'm missing something, today's announcement on many of those issues is actually relatively dull for BT on the basis that maybe it's coming. Maybe it's going to come in 3 or 6 months' time. You know, sometimes it takes time to look through these things thoroughly. But, you know, I'm a bit surprised. It's months now. And actually, the statement was relatively dull. It said all the right things about the need for investment, but then maybe didn't really change as much as people thought. Clearly, it's a work in progress. You've got to turn a super tanker around with companies of this size. But there you go. The share has shrugged its shoulders, and we crack on. My personal view is still it's a value share and worthwhile holding on to if you're a holder here, or thinking about if you haven't got it from both an income and a capital growth potential over the next 12 or 24 months.
Yeah, do you know what? While we're talking there, I was looking at my charts on TradingView, and I have alert set up, and I have alert set up on the price and relative strength because it's a momentum indicator. And while we were chatting there, and I just mentioned it beforehand, but I yesterday lowered the alert on the IUKD shares with the dividend paying fund ETF, and it has tripped it again right then. So it's now their relative strength, they just hit 23. That last went down this level, like they're back in the sell off, end of last year. And before that, it doesn't happen very often, but twice a year it happens. So we can see the stocks there, you know, relatively weak at the moment, historically. So, you know, you get paid for that in dividends, yeah. so it's decent.
That's right.
Mm. Okay.
No, it's the same. Look at Imperial Branch yesterday. Exactly the same sort of setup. You know, big dividend, actually dividend growth share, that one, but big dividend, absolute dividend yield. Share price came down yesterday on actually what I thought were quite workable numbers. But there you go. Market is clearly out of favour on these stocks. As always, but sometimes when things are out of favour, there might be an opportunity. So certainly an area of the market I'll be sniffing around on.
Yeah, and I just think, I don't know what you think about funds, but I think, you know, when you're covering 50 stocks that are dividend payers and they're sort of, they are screened for dividend, I think, you know, sort of the cover and all that stuff, you know. So it's pretty much, in my mind, when they hit a low like this, it's quite a safe bet, you know, because you straight away in one buy, you are diversifying across 50 companies, you know. So it's not like you're just making a big bet on one company, you know. So I think it's a relatively safe bet. So I quite like that kind of ETF for dividend exposure, because I'm not a big fan of having to dig through companies and looking at their dividend cover and all that stuff. I just don't find that very exciting, you know, so I'll let everyone else do that for me. Anyway, any other stocks, Chris, out there?
Well, got to think a quick one on Superdry. Now, we've talked before about the disasters of Superdry. Look at the share price over the last year, tells you everything you need to know, which is, you know, a plummet from sort of, I mean, well over 10 quid a share, £15 a share, £16 a share, something like that, all the way down to £4 a share. And the thing has gone sideways over the last sort of 3-4 months, broadly speaking. As obviously there's been this big proxy battle over one of the co-founders, somebody who sort of stepped away from the business in an executive fashion, retained a bunch of shares in it, got truly hacked off with how it was being managed and everything else, has come back, rallied other investors and related, got himself put back in charge, and obviously now is trying to push out the new plan. But as always, as we just talked about with BT, things take time sometimes. What's striking about today's announcement is three things. Number one is there's another profits warning. So there looks a bit like a kitchen sink really on this, as saying actions to stabilize performance is ongoing, but you know, conditions are still so tricky that they've had to issue a profit warning. You know, they're saying that revenues are slightly up, but, you know, there's poor wholesale and e-commerce performance. You know, e-commerce going wrong for a clothing retail company like Superdry, that's an absolute shocker, because, of course, e-commerce is just an inherent growth area. So, you know, shows the real malaise they've had. But what's interesting is the shares actually, when I last looked a couple of minutes ago, were slightly up on the day. They initially dropped, I think, on the news of the profits downgrade again, and they turned around. And that is I have to say, I know you're a fan, relatively speaking, Justin, of Superdry clothing. I'm not.
Do you know what? I'm not. The thing is, I think this is where they're going wrong. This Julian Dunkerton is back in now. I think when he was in charge, it was a different market. I think they were sort of, you know, fashion, as we know, changes, very cyclical. You know, it's very short lived, very flippant. People wearing it, and so, I think he's going to have a struggle here, because I think the brand is all wrong. He's going to change it. Those big bold letters are something that turned me off. My wife got me some, you know, in the sale T-shirts, and I thought, oh, I quite like the shape of them. But as I went on, I thought, I hate having these massive brands plastered all over me. I just want something subtle, and I think they're going to have to really bring that down, because I don't think people are like that. Even you know, someone of my age who's not sort of fashion conscious per se, I don't like that big brand on me. You know, I don't like it. I want it a bit more subtle than that.
That's it. So you don't want to be a walking billboard or whatever.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if he can turn it round, because he can't do what he did beforehand. You know, they had a bit of a first move advantage in that field there. He can't do that now. It's a different, more competitive market out there, and so I'll see if Julian Dunkerton can turn it around. Whether it's just where it's the business, or it's the actual sector itself, you know? I think
these are wise observations. You know, for me, it's too early to invest in this one for two reasons. Number one is, I totally agree with your top-down view that actually things maybe have changed, and what worked 10 years ago maybe just isn't as relevant today. There's no doubt a simplistic job of tidying things up, focus, and whatever else. You know, there may be something there. I think what we may ultimately get is just that Superdry. It is a sustainable business, it's not just a smaller one. And hence, maybe the market cap is just not very exciting. His opportunity is undoubtedly that they fortunately have got a good balance sheet, which is always a positive. Because clearly what you don't want is a bunch of debt on all of these issues at the same time. So that's the one positive. But for me, it's too early in a competitive market. And you know, you could say also the shares are up 20% from the very early year lows. So you know, there has been a little bit of a bounce based on hope, but I think today's numbers show that it's going to be a long haul back. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's not as if you know, as I say, they're growing very fast, because as discussed, they're not. So one to watch. But in terms of the technical action, quite interesting the fact that they're slightly up today. So there's a little bit more of optimism into the statement despite the warning.
Yeah, and do you know what, it'll be interesting to see whether they get that £4 level, which was touched or closed just below that in December last year. So and they've come up again. They went from that to sort of almost 550, and so they're heading now back towards 490 now. But I mean, it'd be interesting to see if they touch that again, just retest that as a double bottom. That'd be a nice support level to test, I think, retest.
That's right. Well, I think, you know, it's in sort of a chat, I mean, I'm not a technologist, but it looks like it's in a chat between about £4 and, as you say, sort of 550, 570, something like that. So I think as an investor, you can wait and see which way it breaks, basically, and take your views from that. So, but, you know, as always, as we often say on this chat, you know, go and have a look at the shops. If you're really interested in investing in Superdry, go to the shop, see what you think, have a kick the clothes rail.
I genuinely think it's for the guys, but like me, who have no really, you know, not really into fashion, but they think that's quite fashionable for their age. It'll do. It's, you know, it's the other shops are too fashionable and they're too out there. But I've gone now to what is this, what's the Wills, what's it called, Wills, I can't think of the name. I got Wills on me.
Wait. This is way beyond my knowledge. There's some things I know about, some things I don't. And but on trend fashion retailers, Justin, is. I'm going to leave that one to you.
Let me have a look at the back.
You're looking at the back of your jumper,
yes,
or something?
Jack Wills. Jack Wills. I've got now. And the t-shirts are just a lot nicer. They fit very well. They're more subtle. There's a tiny little logo which you wouldn't know. Sometimes it just says Wills. Sometimes it just. But rather than just having a massive Superdry shouting at everyone, I don't want that. You know, that's what Superdry, it just shouts to people. I think we're now more subtle than that, you know, but there we are. Cool. What's anything else, Chris?
Quick final one on Barratt Developments. Look, we had some pretty shabby sounding housing data out earlier today, talking about not only state agents feeling pessimistic, but also a lack of supply of new houses, prices still under pressure, and all of that sort of stuff that I guess many people see on a micro basis in the local housing market. So housing big picture is still problematic, even before we get to Brexit and help to buy and all of that other gubbins. Barratt, though, they kind of slightly bucked the trend, I thought, because most of the house builders have come out and sort of said, it's sort of all right, but our margins are a bit under pressure because we're having to either make sure that we raise the standard of the quality of our housing, that's Persimmon, or just generally seeing some input cost pressures, which are companies like Crest and Taylor & Wimpey. But Barratt actually have come out and said their numbers are slightly ahead of hopes in terms of the outlook for the full year. Good progress on their targets, and forward sales up 2.4% sort of year on year in the first little part of this year. And you know, one, it's not great, but again, it was a slightly more positive statement than I was anticipating. Saying that, my big picture view on the housing market and the house building sector remains cautious and pessimistic. And, you know, I think the Barratt shares, again, are slightly up, a bit like Superdry shares on the day. But you look at the chart on this one, and I still think it's rolling over. Again, I'm no technical expert, but when I kind of sort of merge it with my fundamental view, still this one is under pressure, even before you get to the discussion over whether the government should keep on supporting things like Help to Buy, which is no doubt boosting house builder profits and distorting the market.
Yeah. Do you know what? Look at the chart, and it's not looking good from a momentum point of view. You've got the MACD rolling down over the zero. You've got the relative strength going down below 50. I mean, essentially, they are momentum indicators. And this, like I say, the price is rolling over. So I think it's just trying to find some support somewhere. But it's not in a, you know, it's not in a short-term uptrend at the moment. It's a downtrend. So I'd let it settle somewhere, you know. So who knows?
That's right. And you are, I mean, and we talked about dividend already. You are getting getting some income clearly from these names. I mean, Barrett is a sensible yielder. It's not quite a sort of BT Group or Imperial Brands yielder, but you know, it's a decent yielder. It's got other capital programs as well in terms of buybacks. So you know, as an income investor, it probably is a constituent of that fund you mentioned 5-10 minutes ago. But I have to say, it's a micro investment. I'm chilling on that. I'm not investing in them. I say my macro view makes me cautious, and I just think that this is not an area to be in.
Yeah, I agree. For now, I'm not liking it. It's like the head of a sort of dinosaur bending over, coming down, and where it'll stop, no one knows at the moment. So, marvellous stuff. Thanks for that, Chris, and we'll catch up next week, fella.
Sounds planned. See you then.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Ektech, EQT, ticker there, at four, Sirius Minerals, at three, Scanel Holdings, at two, ECR Minerals, and number one most followed company is BIDS, Bidstack Group, of course, having a good rise there after the fundraise. James came on the podcast, and Fran, the CTO and CEO of the company, came on the podcast, and I'm a big fan of the guys there, what they're doing, and their potential going forward. Okay, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, Riabol Resources, increased investment in Danny Petroleum. At four, EVR Holdings, EVR final results year ended 31st December. At three, Powerhouse Energy Group, developer WT2 signed power agreement. Another step in the right direction there for Powerhouse. At two, Highlands Natural Resources, trading update. And number one, Vesarion. Hopefully you get Neil on the podcast soon, talking about the USA update they released today. That's it for the podcast. Before I go, don't forget, again, just a quick reminder, if you have downloaded the Vox Markets app and you find it very useful, please, by all means, give us a couple of seconds and a couple of minutes and give us a decent review on the Apple's App Store or the Android Store to make it sort of easier for other people to find if they're looking for investment apps. Thanks very much for that. Muchos appreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.